Good afternoon. I hope there are more people coming in here. I know Section G is one that everybody loves to hate. And I completely understand. But hopefully, by the time you leave here, you'll feel a little bit better about it. One thing that I do want to say before we get started with ADLs, which is GO110, and that is, it looks very much like the MDS 2.0 version. And they have a lot of things in common. But because there are so many differences, I very strongly recommend that you take what you know about coding MDS 2.0 and leave it out in the hall, in the lobby. Seriously, you know, if you can separate yourself from it and just leave it out there until you need it later when you go back to your facilities, that would be a really good thing. That's probably true of the MDS 3.0 in general, isn't it? That there's so much that's new that it really needs to be approached as something completely new and different rather than looked at as an update to the 2.0. And certainly with ADLs, I think that's really true. So Jennifer mentioned to you what it is that we're going to be talking about, so I won't repeat that again. But I just want to sort of bring it all together. You know, we're talking about ADLs, and we're talking about balance, and we're talking about range of motion. And what it all has to do with is bringing to the forefront everything you can possibly find out about an individual's functional status. Again, because what we're trying to do in the nursing home is to help individuals maintain independence. And identifying functional status is critically important. And the other piece of that that is critically important, that this is just me, Rena Shepherd, but I think that we don't do enough of it, and that is identifying the risk for functional decline and being proactive in developing care plans to mitigate the risk, you know, to at least minimize it, if not eliminate it. But that's a whole different seminar. But I'm just sort of planting food for thought. One of the things that we do with this section, whether it's with 2.0 or 3.0, is we compare, don't we, one assessment to the prior to see if there's been a decline. And if we identify a decline at that point and hadn't recognized it prior to that, it's probably too late to do. I mean, it could be 3 months ago. And so it may be too late to be able to help the resident, you know, in a meaningful way regain some function. So I just wanted to sort of put it in that context. But mainly what we're going to do is talk about nuts and bolts here of coding this section. And these are the objectives, which, once again, I know you don't need me to read. And the intent of Section G, we've pretty much talked about that, and you can see what that says. And, of course, the last bullet point here, documenting the resident and staff assessment about potential for functional rehab, is, you know, that's another item on the MDS, I think, on admission assessments. And talking about the importance of this section, talking about the importance of the awareness of the functional status of the resident, this is just sort of pulling together some of the factors that can adversely affect physical function. And you can see what they are in terms of physical and medical conditions, neurological conditions, cognitive factors can certainly affect physical function. And then you have all of the complications of immobility or decreased mobility that arise when physical functioning is adversely affected. And those are certainly some of them that are listed there. All the things that we want to try to avoid. You know, even with the five-star system, the five-star quality rating system, two of the quality measures that are used for that system are ADLs, and they have extra weight. Did Did you ever notice that? It makes sense. I mean, because physical functioning is, well, just like these slides are saying, just enormously important to residents and their health and their well-being. So that importance can't really be understated. Okay, let's take a look. If you'll turn in your MDS book to G0110. And it does look very familiar to you 2.0 folks. But don't let that make you tune me out, because I have a lot to say that, like I said, is different. Dependence on others. You know, that's the other thing that dovetails with what I've been talking about, the health issues and the feelings of well-being, and the negative impacts with functional decline. And this is another little twist on it, that when you find yourself dependent on others, I bet everybody in this room who's worked in a nursing home or even a hospital for any length of time at all has run into somebody who, when he became dependent on others to have to get to the bathroom and became incontinent, decided he was never going to leave his room again. Did you ever meet somebody like that? That's kind of what this is about. You can imagine what that feels like. So looking at column one, ADL self-performance. So this is determining which ADLs the resident performed across all shifts, assessing the resident self-performance. In other words, what this is all about is in column one, it's all about how much did the resident do for himself versus how much staff had to do for him. And when we are assessing an individual's function for column one, ADL self-performance, and of course there are two columns, but for this column, we need to look at what the resident actually did for himself. We can't code based on what we think he should be doing or what we know he could have done if his wife hadn't always done it for him, that sort of thing, or hadn't always done it for him when she was there. So that's the point. We have to observe what it is the resident has done and code based on that. And now this is looking at all of the each of the different ADL activities that are listed in A through J, and looking at each episode of the ADL activity that occurred during the 7-day look back, each episode. Whether it was 5 episodes in the whole 7-day period, or whether it was 5 episodes every shift for the whole 7-day period. We're looking at the episodes and how the resident functioned for each one of those episodes. And that's just sort of the bottom line that we're getting to here. And so if you look on the item set where it says ADL self-performance, and it says this on the slide too, it says code for the resident's performance over all shifts, not including setup, because setup is coded in column 2. If the ADL activity occurred 3 or more times at various levels of assistance, code the most dependent, except for total dependence, which requires full performance every time. We're going to talk about all that. But, you know, there are really 2 reasons, I think. This is just my understanding of you know, the research and my observations. 2 reasons for a lot of the errors that occur with the 2.0. And I think that they could easily be carried over to the 3.0 if we're not careful. One of them is not really understanding what the actual definition is for each of the ADL activities. They have precise definitions, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But it's that precise definition with each component of the definition listed there. The, each component is what the resident needs to be rated on, not some assumptions about what the definition is. And then the other thing, of course, is confusion over how to actually code it, looking at the coding from 0 to 4 and then 7 and 8. So you hear us talk, and you talk about the rule of three. We're going to go into that in detail as well. But that's what is being alluded to where I read the ADL self-performance definition. And so just to get you started, unless the activity occurred, the activity itself, let's say the activity is transfer. Unless transfer occurred three or more times, you cannot code 0 through 4. That is a prerequisite for 0 through 4 coding, that the activity itself occurred at least three times in the 7-day look-back period. So you know, if you know, for transfer, if the guy only got out of bed and back in once in the whole 7-day look-back period, you're not going to be able to code 0 through 4. It's got to be some other code, okay? So that's the beginning of the rule of three. That's the foundation, that in order to get higher, you know, to get more into the coding, it has to occur three or more times. Okay, so that's sort of the overview, just to get you going. So column two, then, is going to measure the most support provided by staff to complete the ADL activity. So you're going to be coding the most support. If the resident received any kind of oversight or cueing or hands-on physical assistance, you're going to be coding the highest level of dependence, even if it occurred only once. And of course, setup is also included there. And we'll talk about these definitions in detail. And as far as the last bullet point there, I just think it's so important to know that if you try to code, let's say you're doing transfer, and then you code column one and column two, and then you do the next one, column one and column two, you're much more likely to make mistakes than if you start with bed mobility transfer and keep on going down, finish column one, and then go up to the top and do column two. And the reason is because the rules for the two different columns are so different that if you try to go back and forth, you kind of don't get your head out of the rules for column one and you're in column two and you can make mistakes. So that's why that recommendation is there. Code them, code one column and then code the other. More likely to not get confused. Okay, so how do we collect this information? Where does it come from? Well, review the medical record. And certainly talk with direct care staff from each shift that is cared for the resident. Determine what each resident does independently during each episode of each ADL activity definition. Determine the type and level of staff assistance provided. And we're going to go into these definitions of what staff assessment is, the oversight, verbal cueing, encouragement, physical assistance, full staff performance. We'll go into great detail over that. And be very specific, and this is what I was talking about in the overview. Make sure that whoever is doing the coding for GO110 understands completely what each component of the ADL activity is. Like bed mobility, which is what the example is on the slide. You know, as a nurse, I think of bed mobility, and mainly when I think about it, I think of maybe turning side to side in bed and maybe, you know, shifting position in bed. But we don't want to forget, look at the definition, that it also includes moving from a lying position. Maybe he needs more help to do that, right? And maybe even, maybe he needs more help laying down. So he was sort of independent, moving side to side. But what was happening with his moving from a lying to a sitting position? That was a lot more help, right? You could hear me struggling. I was bearing his weight, wasn't I? I was sort of lifting him. It is that component of the activity that bed mobility will be coded on. That assistance, if assuming bed mobility occurred three or more times, and assuming that the staff had to provide at least that much assistance three or more times, that's the component that will determine the code. So that's why it's so important to understand what the components are and not to add components where there aren't any, you know, making assumptions. And also, well, for example, if you look at transfer, the definition, look on the form because the definitions are right on the item set. How a resident moves between surfaces, including to or from bed, chair, wheelchair, standing position. So those are the components you're looking at. So any bed mobility in preparation for getting out of bed is not transfer, right? And chair mobility after in the chair is not part of the transfer, according to the definition, right? So that's why it's so important to pay attention to those definitions. And as the last bullet point says, ask probing questions, beginning with the general and proceeding to the more specific. So you should be talking to the resident, of course, anytime you're trying to figure out what's going on with the resident. A really good place to start is with the resident. But also when you're talking to the staff about how the resident has performed with the staff, you just want to make sure that you collect the information that you need, that it's specific enough. And don't make assumptions. You know, just ask more questions, more specific questions if you need to, until you get the information that you need. So for column one, record actual resident self-performance. And of course, and this is really important, self-performance may vary from day to day, shift to shift, within shifts, 24 hours a day, and among disciplines. Now, for MDS 3.0, it's only staff assistance that is captured. So that's what the definition is. It is whatever you see the definition there, but with staff assistance only, or resident, of course. The resident could do it himself or staff assistance. And so it is quite possible and maybe even likely that the resident is going to perform differently with PT in the morning than he is with transfers with nursing on the night shift in the middle of the night transferring to the bedside commode, right? So, you know, sometimes people say to agree with me that this is the person's level. Well, they don't have to. Because what you're going to do is collect information on all the episodes that occurred and then sort of put them in their piles of how much assistance was required and then apply the coding rules, the rule of three, and you'll come up with the right answer. And, of course, the chart needs to support all that. So also, the third bullet point there, when you are considering the resident's performance, if the resident uses adaptive devices, for example, if he uses his walker for transfers, then you want to hopefully have him using his walker for the transfers. Now, if he refuses to use his walker, that's a different issue. But that's what that's getting to. And do not include assistance provided by family or other visitors. So there's a certain question that generally arises from that statement. Does anybody have that question in your mind at the moment? Well, the question is, you know, what if there's a private duty person and the resident never participates, the staff doesn't do anything, this private duty or the family member does. Well, since the definition requires that it only be the resident or staff, that would mean that the activity did not occur according to the definition. Now, that would be only if the resident never did anything and the staff never did anything. And I don't know how often that occurs, but I sure know that the question comes up all the time. So that doesn't mean that there may not be some other care planning involved related to what's going on with the people who are providing that particular aspect of care. But as far as coding the MDS, you can only capture episodes that occurred, either the resident did it or it was staff assistance. Okay, so assess the resident's functional status for each ADL. Determine if it occurred three or more times, because that's the threshold, right, that I mentioned in the overview. That's the threshold. And document the level of assistance, if any, that the resident required to complete the activity each time it occurred. Consider each episode of the activity that occurred during the look-back period, and do not record the staff's assessment of the resident's potential capability, which is what I was talking about earlier. It's just what the resident actually did with staff. So, there are three primary categories of information collected with GO-110. Which ADLs the resident performed during the look-back period? Did the ADL occur three or more times during the look-back period? That's the threshold question. And what type of assistance? And once that information is collected, then you can apply the coding rules. So, coding guidelines. Determine if each ADL activity occurred three or more times. Apply the rule of three to determine the resident's level of self-performance. And use the ADL self-performance algorithm, and we're going to talk about that. If you would take the algorithm out of your packets if you haven't done that already. And by the way, while you're doing that, I just want to mention that the category of staff, you know, that it has to be the assistance provided by staff, that could be contract staff, you know, registry staff. A number of people have asked that question, too. Yeah, that they're considered to be staff because the facility is. So this algorithm provides a step-by-step guide, and it will get you to where you need to go. Generally speaking, I mean, I think it's really important to understand the rule of three and to understand the concept behind it, and that is just what I said to you. Once you realize that the activity occurred at least three times in the look-back period, then what you do is you collect all of those episodes and you put them in the piles of how much assistance was required and apply the coding rules. And that's at the point, after you put them in the piles and you know how often they occurred at each level, that's when the algorithm kicks in for you. So, yeah, the thing about starting at the top of the algorithm, I mentioned that to you this morning, too. And there is a tendency to want to, you know, cut to the middle of something that covers a full page and try to start there. That'll mess you up because you got to go through the top. So what we're going to do is walk through we're going to walk through the algorithm so you can see how it works. The first step, you know, as I mentioned, is to determine if the activity occurred three or more times. And then start at the top where it says start here. And the first question is, did the activity occur at least one time? And of course, if the answer is no, then that takes you over. You see how it takes you right over to the code 8. The activity did not occur. But let's say the activity did occur one time. So we go down the algorithm. Did the activity occur three or more times? Well, let's say no, it didn't. Well, we already said that it did occur, right? So now we're saying it didn't occur three times. So that doesn't leave very many options. So it occurred once or twice. There's a code for that with MDS3O, and that is the code 7. So that takes us over to the code 7, okay? So, but let's say the activity did occur three or more times, okay? So now, as we go down the algorithm, now we're doing it with the understanding, okay, the activity occurred three or more times, and now we're going to look and see what all the episodes added up to in terms of the final code. So, so the next step is, where were we? The next step is, oh, right, did the resident fully perform the ADL activity without any help or oversight from the staff every time? And if the answer to that is yes, then the code is independent. And the thing about that is that I want to point out to you, to you 2.0 folks, is that this is a big change. And I don't like to talk about 2.0 because we left that out in the lobby. But please notice that it says code 0 if the resident did not need any assistance or oversight to complete the ADL activity. There are no exceptions. So if the activity occurred three or more times, and the resident required no assistance whatsoever every time it occurred, that's when you use the zero code with MDS3O. Okay? So, let's say, back to the algorithm, that the answer to that question was no. So it's not independent. So that's going to take us to the next one. Did the resident require full staff performance every time? And that means that the staff had to do That means that the activity occurred at least three times, and every single time it occurred, the staff had to do everything. There was total non-participation by the resident. If that's the case, that's when the code 4 applies, total dependence. Okay? Okay, so that gets us then, let's say that the answer to that question was no. So we're going down the algorithm. So for the next one, the question is, did the resident require full staff performance at least three times, but not every time? Well, here's what that means. That means that the activity occurred at least three times. And some of the episodes, the resident did nothing and the staff performed the entire activity for the resident. But not every time. If they did it every time, what would the code be? 4, right. But there are episodes here where the staff helped. So it can't be a 4. That makes it a 3. So that's what that means. Full staff performance on the algorithm, full staff performance at least three times, but not every time. And you see that takes you over to code 3, extensive. Now, the other part of that is, and you see this on the slide, if the resident performs part of the ADL with the staff providing weight-bearing assistance, then, of course, that's also going to get us to extensive assistance. So looking at the algorithm, we were at, did the resident require full staff performance at least three times but not every time? The answer is no. Did the resident require a combination of full staff performance and weight-bearing assistance three or more times? Here's what that means. That means let me put it this way. When you have somebody that requires full staff performance every time, you know that that's total dependence. But what do you call those episodes of full staff performance when they don't occur every time, they're just some of the time? What do you do with them? Well, the answer is they are weight-bearing assistants, right? I mean, if they're full staff performance, it occurred three or more times, full staff performance 100% of the time, it's total dependence. But what if the activity occurred three or more times and it was full staff performance part of the time but not all of the time? What do you call those full staff performance? Call them weight-bearing. Are you with me? Okay, because that's an extremely important concept to understand. There's no magic to it, it's just that it's never actually been pulled out that way and explained that way before. So that brings us then to, if you're looking at the algorithm, where it says, did resident require a combination of full staff performance, in other words, those weight-bearing assistants that the resident didn't participate at all, and weight-bearing assistance by the definition that the staff is providing weight-bearing assistance, but the resident performs part of it. So if you have a combination of those two, and it adds up to three or more times, that also takes you to extensive assistance. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Okay. Really, and we're going to illustrate this in a minute, but all that means is that you have episodes of weight-bearing assistance called by two different labels. One of them is full staff performance, the other is weight-bearing, but they're both weight-bearing assistants. Okay, and now the rest of the slide that you see up on the screen right now, let's go through that. The resident performs part of the ADL activity with the staff providing weight-bearing assistance. So that would be supporting the resident's hand during eating or lifting the resident's arm over the head so the resident can brush his or her hair, lifting up the foot to help put the sock on. So that's that weight-bearing assistance. And if you have a situation where the activity occurred three or more times and the most dependent level of assistance that occurred three or more times was this, then it's extensive also. Right? That's probably a little bit more familiar. The other piece of it is the next bullet point, and that is the staff fully performs an ADL. We talked about that. The staff performs the ADL 100% of it, some of the time but not all of the time. But the other piece is if the staff performs a component of the activity three or more times, it's also extensive assistance. So in the first case, let's say that the staff had to completely feed the resident for some meals. But for other meals, the resident actually participated in it. So that's going to be extensive, right? Because the staff actually performed the whole activity. Some of the time, but not all the time. Okay. To illustrate the other example, let's say the resident is dressing, and he's able to perform most of the activity himself, but there's one component of it, like maybe he can't get his pants on. So the staff does that for him three or more times. That's extensive assistance. They didn't do the whole dressing activity, but they did a whole component of it. You see how that works? And so that's also extensive assistance. Always remembering that you can only code the four when, the total dependence, when the staff performs the entire activity every single time it happened, and it happened three or more times. So never forgetting that. Okay. As if you could forget that, right? Okay, let's go down the algorithm then. And we're going to talk about limited assistance. And the description of limited assistance is on the slide. The resident was highly involved in the activity, received help in guided maneuvering or other non-weight-bearing assistance. And as the slide says, the guided maneuvering versus weight-bearing assistance is determined by who's supporting the weight of the resident's extremity. Guided maneuvering could be directing the resident in completing a task, not providing weight-bearing assistance. Guided maneuvering would be hands-on physical assistance guiding the resident. So an example would be, I'm walking down the hall with my resident, and he has a gait belt on, and I'm holding the gait belt at his waist and sort of holding onto his arm. You see him standing here? He's tall. He has kind of gray, white hair. You see him? I think Anne talked to you about hallucinations already, right? Okay, we're having a group hallucination. Okay, here's my resident. And we're walking down the hall, and he's doing a really good job. And you might say, well, Rena, why do you have your hands on him? Are you trying to up code so you can get a higher code? Well, no, the reason, I would not do that. The reason that I have my hands on him is because he tends to bump into things. He gets drifty. And I just kind of steer him. I guide him away. You know how it is when you're dancing with somebody? You know the kind where you touch each other? And the person who's leading, say you're dancing with somebody who's leading, that person doesn't pick you up and dance you around the floor, right? They just go around the floor. So that's what I'm doing with him. I'm basically dancing down the hall with him, gait belt and all, steering him away. That's guided maneuvering, which is very different from, picking him up and bearing his weight. And another good example of that, of course, is eating. Because when somebody, maybe he's able to get the food on the spoon, and he aims for his mouth, but he doesn't quite get there, so we guide it to his mouth. That's guided maneuvering. But then, let's say partway through the meal, he gets tired, and now we're doing hand over hand, helping him to get that spoon to his mouth. So that's the difference. We moved from guided maneuvering to weight-bearing assistance. And, it can happen that quickly. I mean, I could be dancing down the hall with my resident, and he could lose his balance, and I could be bearing his weight. And now I'm bearing his weight, and I'm hopefully going to be able to get him back up on his feet. But that's the difference between guided maneuvering and, and hopefully we don't just end up on the floor together, right? Yeah. And I know, I knew somebody was going to say that. It's an intercepted fall. I knew I was in trouble when I said that. Flashed through my mind. Thank you. I think. All right, so guided maneuvering. Okay, so let's go back then to the, and then on the next slide, we have to go back to the algorithm. So we have, we did extensive assistance, and it was no. So did the resident require non-weight-bearing assistance three or more times? So that's the guided maneuvering, non-weight-bearing assistance, which would be less, but let's say no. So then the next one is, did the resident require a combination of full staff performance weight-bearing. You know that combination that we talked about when full staff performance actually is weight-bearing? So a combination of those two and non-weight-bearing assistants for a total of three or more. So in other words, if we had three of the combination of full staff performance and weight-bearing, that would be what? Extensive, right? The combination, if we had three or more of full staff performance combined with weight-bearing, that would be extensive. What the next one is saying, if we have a combination of full staff performance, weight-bearing assistance, but it wouldn't be three or more, it would be less than, it would be one or two, plus non-weight-bearing assistance three or more times, that combination will give us limited assistance as well. And if we say no to that, then the next one is, did the resident require oversight, encouragement, or cueing three or more times, that supervision? If the answer is no, if you came all the way down the algorithm and every answer did not apply, you hit the bottom, the answer is automatically supervision. So let's go through the rule of three. Let's work on this some more. When an activity occurs three times at any one level, code it at that level. The highest level of assistance that occurred three or more times. So if it occurred, I don't know, the activity occurred 15 times, and three times it occurred at one level, that's the level you code, the highest level of assistance that occurred three or more times. So let's see. So for example, a resident requires weight-bearing assistance three or more times, but not every time, during the look-back period to transfer, you're going to code it what? Weight-bearing assistance three or more times is the highest level of assistance that occurred three or more times. That's extensive, right? Okay. And here's an example on the slide. It says when an activity occurs three or more times at more than one level, you're still going to code the most dependent level that occurred three or more times. So in this example, you had extensive three times, you had limited three times. What are you going to code it? Extensive. The highest level of assistance that occurred three or more times. Exactly. What do you think would happen, before we go here, let me back up. What do you think it would be if you had three times extensive and six times limited? What would it be? It's still extensive, right? Guy, you guys are still awake and alert at this hour? Sometimes people tend to think of it as, well, it occurred six times at limited, so that was more times than it occurred at extensive. Excuse me, I dropped something. But because it occurred at extensive three or more times, it's coded as extensive. So then, when an activity occurs at more than one level, but not three times at any one level. So it occurred at least three times, but not three times at any one level. This is the place where people sometimes get confused. And we already did, you know, an overview of all of that. But we're going to look at that more closely now. So episodes that occur at more than one level may be combined, as you saw when we went through the algorithm, to determine the level of assistance required. And when considering episodes in combination, and this is what we were already talking about, full staff performance is considered to be weight-bearing assistance. So this is a graphic that tries to explain that concept. So what you see here is when three or more episodes of a combination of full staff performance and weight-bearing assistance occur coded extensive. Because those episodes, the one episode of full staff performance that you see there, in this case, translates to weight-bearing assistance. So you actually have three episodes of weight-bearing assistance here. So you can combine those levels of physical hands-on assistance that require, you know, weight-bearing to get your three. When three or more episodes of a combination of full staff performance weight-bearing and non-weight-bearing occur, code limited. So you heard me talking about that when we were going through the algorithm as well. And so what that means is that you have weight-bearing assistance, right? But you don't have three or more. So you're not going to get up to extensive, right? I mean, that's basically what that means. But you do have two other episodes of hands-on physical assistance, but at the limited assistance level, at the non-weight-bearing level. So you can combine those episodes and code it as what? Limited. That's right. Because always remember, you can never get into the higher category until it occurs how many times? Three times at that level. That's the rule of three. Very good. And this is just a reminder that three or more episodes of weight-bearing assistance must occur in order to code it as three. So you've got a full staff performance there, you've got a weight-bearing and a non-weight-bearing. So that's not going to get you there, right? Because you don't have three at a weight-bearing level. So that's another example of limited assistance. So here's a scenario. And I think you're going to need your algorithm for this. But a resident experienced a severe case of flu during the look-back period. Maybe you won't. Observations indicate that the resident required the following assistance for toilet use. So we have one, yeah, you are going to need it. One time of weight-bearing, one time non-weight-bearing, and one time with nothing. In other words, it would be independent. So what do you think it's going to be? If you go down the algorithm, work through the algorithm. I know some of you already understand where it gets you, but did the activity occur at least one time? Yes. Did it occur three or more times? Did the activity itself occur three or more times? Yes. Did the resident fully perform the ADL activity without any help or oversight from the staff every time? No. Did the resident require full staff performance every time? No. How about did the resident require full staff performance at least three times, but not every time? No, I don't see that there. Did the resident require a combination of full staff performance and weight bearing three or more times? No. Did the resident require non-weight bearing assistance three or more times? No. Did the resident require a combination of that full staff performance and weight bearing combined with non-weight bearing three or more times? No. Did the resident require oversight, encouragement, or cueing three or more times? No. So what's the answer? Supervision. Right. And of course, you don't see supervision actually having occurred, right? But supervision is the correct answer. Just so you know. Oh, let's see what we have here. Extensive assistance. Okay. The ADL has to have occurred at least three times during the look-back period. And in that case, code a three, if full staff performance was required at least three times, but not every time. And I think you get that one, right? I think folks are probably pretty comfortable with that. So that was the question, did the resident require full staff performance at least 3 times but not every time on the algorithm? And the answer is yes, so it's just going to take you right over to extensive assistance. And so if you just work your way down the algorithm, you can see, you know, how you end up there. Okay, so then the ADL occurred at least 3 times during the look-back period, and then code 3, if a combination of full staff performance and weight-bearing was required 3 or more times. So we saw that as we came down the algorithm. And then we also saw the limited assistance, which is a lot simpler, right? Non-weight-bearing assistance as the highest level of dependence that occurred 3 or more times. And also limited assistance, that, and we saw this too, when we have a combination of full staff performance weight-bearing, but not 3 or more times, which would give us extensive, so it's only 1 or 2 times, and non-weight-bearing assistance for a total of 3 or more, which takes us to limited. And the supervision. And that's how we reached the bottom. Is it beginning to make sense? Well, you know what they say? They say adult learners really do need to hear things multiple times. Not only adult learners, but I study mainly about adult learners because I don't teach kids. So some people say, well, why do they repeat things so much? That's why. Because a lot of times it takes a while, you know, for anybody, kids or adults, to get new concepts. So here's a scenario. Let me find the scenario here. Okay. So the ADL activity is G0110D, walk-in corridor. Mrs. Q requires verbal cueing and physical guiding of her hand placement on the walker when walking down the unit hallway. And of course, anytime you're reading a scenario and you hear or read about a certain level of assistance, just take your pen, you know, and write down what level of assistance that is. And when you're all done, you'll be able to go back and see what you have in terms of the episodes and apply the rule of three. She needs frequent verbal reminders of how to use her walker, where to place her hands, and to pick up her feet. Mrs. Q needs to be physically guided to the day room. During the look-back period, the resident was noted to ambulate in the hallway daily and required this support from one staff member. So if you identify the levels of the various levels of assistance that occurred, we have, starting with bullet number 2, verbal cueing, physical guiding of her hand placement. So what's that? The physical guiding of her hand placement? So that's going to be limited, right? And then we have frequent verbal reminders. That's supervision. That's 1. She needs to be physically guided to the day room. So that's limited again, right? Okay, so looking at the algorithm, and you're probably already thinking, okay, it happened 3 or more times because they said daily, so what's it going to come out to? It's going to come out to limited, right? So if you take a look at the algorithm, did the activity occur at least 1 time? Yes. Did it occur 3 or more times? Yes, it was daily. Did the resident fully perform the ADL activity without any help or oversight from the staff every time? No, not even close. Did the resident require full staff performance every time? Not even close there. Did the resident require full staff performance at least 3 times but not every time? No. Did the resident require a combination of full staff performance and weight-bearing assistance 3 or more times? No. Did the resident require non-weight-bearing assistance 3 or more times? Yes. So we're done. The arrow points to limited, and we're done. See how that works? It should get you to the right answer every time, at least to the best of everybody's ability. It does. Let's see, scenario two. Uh-oh, hang on a second. It's not scenario two, it's the description of the scenario. So you see all the types of assistance, and we figured that out up front, and the frequency of assistance, and so we figured that out, and we walked through the algorithm. So we did that already. Okay, so when we get here to the actual coding on the MDS 3.0, you can see where the code 2 was entered for column 1. So now we have algorithm practice. So this is one that will read it and then ask you to walk through the algorithm and come up with the answer. So Mr. F begins eating each meal daily by himself. During the look-back period, after he had eaten only his bread, he stated he was tired and unable to complete the meal. One staff member physically supported his hand to bring the food to his mouth and provided verbal cues to swallow. Mr. F was then able to complete the meal. So how should GO110H column 1 be coded? And of course, these are all of the choices. So take a look at your algorithm and see where that gets you. Even if you already know, it's a good idea to work through the algorithm so it starts to stick in your mind, so that when the more complex cases arise, you're used to the algorithm. So what do you think? There seems to be consensus. So the answer is 3, extensive. The resident partially participated in the task at each meal, but the staff member actually provided weight-bearing assistance with some part of each meal. So what was the weight-bearing assistance? One staff member physically supported the weight of his hand. That is the physical assistance, right? So that's extensive. No, but we're saying that it happened 3 or more times in the look-back period. It's, yeah. Yeah. Well, what would it be? I mean, what if it only occurred that one time? What would the code be? If let's go back to here. Let's say, okay, Mr. F begins eating each meal daily by himself. During the look back period, after he had eaten only his bread, he stated he was tired and unable to complete the meal. One staff member physically supported his hand. Okay, so if you're saying that happened only once, let's say, then what would the level be? It would be what? Would it be independent? What would it be? Supervision. Okay. Why isn't it independent? Because it has to be independent every single time. It has to have occurred at least 3 times, and it has to have been independent every single time it occurred. Right. Very good. Very good. You know, I think that when this was written, where it says he begins eating each meal daily by himself, you know, I think they were trying to imply that this happens every day. But I just think it's great to rework the scenario anyway so that folks can get used to how this works. So that was good. Okay, where are we? Okay, so now let's take a look at the next slide, which is slide 44, and we have another scenario. And this is Mr. P. Mr. P. Do you get that? Mr. P, toileting. Okay, sorry about that. Oh boy. All right. A long day. Okay, the staff must assist Mr. P with the following tasks when using the toilet. And that is zipping his pants, handing him a washcloth, and reminding him to wash his hands. Now, there's something that I need to tell you here. We talked about the fact that when you perform a component of an activity for the resident, and that happens 3 or more times as the highest level of assistance, it's what? Extensive, right? You perform a component. Well, zipping a zipper is not a whole component of an activity. It's sort of a piece of a component or a part of a component. So if you actually hands on for him, you've performed a component. But the zipping his pants is just a non-weight-bearing assistance. Okay? So given that new information, and this occurs multiple times each day, how would Mr. P be coded? What do you think? Limited. Yes, limited. That's right, because of that non-weight-bearing task that was performed for him, and it was 3 or more times as the highest level of assistance that occurred, the most dependent level, right? So it comes out to limited assistance. Okay, so I think that if you grasp the concepts that we talked about of full staff performance translating to weight-bearing assistance and those combinations where you saw the balls that were combined, you'll do fine. You'll be able to use the algorithm and you'll do fine. If you are a trainer, this is a train the trainer, right? Train the trainer session. So if you are a trainer and you're going to go back and train folks on how to code this section, make sure, you know, test them on that and make sure they get that because that's the only way they're going to be able to make it through the algorithm is if they get that piece, okay? The rest of it is sort of more straightforward. All right. Well, you know, as with the 2.0, once you get through column 1, or column A, as we know it in 2.0 land, and you get to column 2, which is column B in 2.0 land, it's a downhill slide from there. And that's true here, too, that column 2 is coding ADL support. And as you know, it's like I said in the overview, you're coding the highest level of assistance that occurred, even if it occurred only once. It's very simple. It doesn't have to have occurred 3 or more times or anything like that. You just look at all of the levels of assistance that were provided and code the one that was most dependent, the highest level. So, as the slide says, complete the ADL self-performance assessment first. And I already talked about those other things and the fact that the rule of three does not apply here. So looking at the codes that are actually on the MDS for this column. Code 0, if the resident completed the activity with no setup help, no physical help at all. Now remember, column 2 captures setup help and hands-on physical assistance. It does not capture supervision or oversight or anything like that. So it's just setup help and hands-on physical assistance. So code 0, if the resident didn't receive any of that. Code 1, if the resident has received setup help only, and that would be being provided materials or devices necessary to perform the ADL independently. And you see some of the examples there. And you might notice on the definition of toilet use, and of course we don't have time in this session to review the details of each of the definitions of the ADL activities, but notice with toilet use, the last line there says, do not include emptying of bedpan, urinal, bedside commode, catheter bag, or ostomy bag. So that doesn't actually get captured. However, if you empty a urinal for somebody and then or a bedpan and you take it and you put it in place so that the resident is able to use it independently, then that's setup help, but not for Foley bags or anything like that. It doesn't translate to that. Okay, so then the next one is code 2 is assist of one person. Code 3 is assist of two or more staff people, persons. And the code 8, of course, is the activity did not occur. And certainly if column 1 is an 8, I think column 2 better be an 8. I don't think it'll accept anything else anyway. My guess is that that it wouldn't. Makes sense. Okay, so here's a scenario. Walk-in corridor, again, Mrs. Q requires verbal cueing and physical guiding of her hand placement on the walker when walking down the unit hallway. She needs frequent verbal reminders of how to use her walker, where to place her hands, to pick up her feet. She needs to be physically guided to the day room. And during the look-back period, she was noted to ambulate in the hallway daily, required this support from one staff member. So how are you going to code this? 2. That's an assist of one, right? Okay. That's not too difficult. And you can see where that's entered on the MDS. Mr. F, he begins eating each meal daily by himself. During the look-back period, after he had eaten only his bread, he stated he was tired, unable to complete the meal. One staff member physically supported his hand to bring the food to his mouth and provided verbal cues to swallow the food. He was then able to complete the meal. So how do we code this? That's an assist of one also, right? And it doesn't matter how many times it occurred, because if it occurred even once at that level as the highest level of assistance that occurred, then that's how it's coded. There you go. And Mr. P. Staff must assist Mr. P with the following tasks when using the toilet. You know what they are. This occurred multiple times each day. So how are we going to code him for column 2? 2. That was an assist of 1, right? Zip up his pants. I don't think it took more than one person to zip up his pants. I don't think so. What if it got stuck, right, and it took 2 people? We're not going there. Moving on. I'm glad you guys have such a good sense of humor, and especially so late in the day. All right, GO120. If you want to take a look at GO120, 2.0 folks, this is very familiar to you. And what I really want to point out is, just like with the 2.0, the rule of three doesn't apply here. The rule of three applies to G0110 column 1 only and nowhere else on the MDS at all, which is worthy of cheering and clapping. But as far as bathing is concerned, I just want to be sure, and hopefully, you know, if you're a 2.0 person, you caught on to this a long time ago, but this coding looks like you might want to call it, you know, supervision limited and extensive, but that's not what it's about. So please just note the difference in the coding here. And first of all, that the code 2 and the code 3, this is where, when you look at the definition of bathing, which is very important to do, so let's look at it on the item set. It's how the resident takes a full body bath, shower, sponge bath, and transfers in and out of the tub shower, excludes washing of the back and hair, code for the most dependent in self-performance and support. So in other words, the highest level of dependence that occurred for each column. Okay, so looking at the definition, it includes obviously the transfer as well as the bath or shower or sponge bath or whatever. So that's the difference there, the code 2 and the code 3, where if he needed assistance with the transfer but not with any aspect of bathing, it's a 2. If he needed help with any aspect of the bathing, that makes it a 3. Unless, of course, it's a 4, which is total dependence. If he needed assistance with transfer and bathing, that makes it a 3. That makes sense, right? So as long as staff helped with the bathing at all, it becomes a 3, unless it's a total dependence. And column 2 is identical to column 2 of AO310. Why did I say A? G, we're in section G, G0110, G0110. No idea where that came from. All right, so the resident received verbal cueing and encouragement to take the twice weekly showers. One staff walked the resident to the bathroom. He bathed himself with periodic oversight. So how should G0120 A and B be coded? Well, how would A be coded? That's right, that's supervision, right? Verbal cueing, encouragement, okay. And then what about column 2? Column 2? So column 2 captures what? Setup help. Did he receive setup help? No. And it captures hands-on physical assistance. Did he receive any of that? No. So it's a 0. That's why you got to do the two columns separately, or you get totally confused. There you go. Well, let's talk about balance during transitions. This is a new item, very different from the 2.0. Think about that. You know, what is it that we test when we test for balance on the 2.0? Standing balance, and what else? Sitting balance. In other words, static balance, right? The person is standing still or sitting still. Is that the time when most of your residents, when they're going to fall, is that when they fall? No. It's probably when they're moving somehow, right? During one of these transitions. And so it probably makes a lot more sense. So if you'll just look at your item set, so that you can see what the transitions are in G0300, A through D. And it does start to make sense that maybe we should be taking a look at that. Certainly, you know, we all know what impaired balance and unsteadiness, what kind of risk that puts anybody at. And this is just kind of summarizing for us what the problems with that can be for the residents. And here's the thing about conducting this assessment. If you look in the manual, and we're going to, you know, and let me just put it that way. If you look in the manual, you will see that it walks you through how to observe the resident doing all of these things in a formal way. You know, have him stand up and have him stand for 3 to 5 seconds and have him walk at least 15 feet and do this and do that. Well, you can do that. You can put him through a formal, you know, observation like that. But you can also just observe the resident during, you know, he might do all of this just getting out of bed and getting himself into the bathroom and turning around and sitting down on the toilet. You know, he just does it. So you can do it that way. I've heard a lot of facilities debating, you know, should rehab be doing this? And it's not necessary, certainly, for rehab to do this. They can do it if they'll do it the way the manual says that it needs to be done. But what I hear therapists saying is that this isn't the way they do things, and you know, if they're not going to do it the formal way that they do it, then it doesn't make any sense for them to do it. But you know, CMS never prescribes who should do these kinds of things. It's just that they have to be done the way the instructions require it. So conduct a review of the resident, as the slide says. Explain what the task is and what's being observed. And you always want to make sure that the resident has whatever assistive devices he or she normally uses. And start, and so this is walking through that formal way of doing it or observing the resident doing these things. And you can see what it says. It's just exactly what I related to you a minute ago. And it does have, you know, if it is going to be an observation of the resident as he moves through his morning routine or whatever, you do want to make sure that he meets the 3 to 5 seconds for standing and that the distance is met. And then you can ask the resident to do these things or just, you know, observe him, like I said, doing them. And the last bullet point here, ask any resident who uses a wheelchair for mobility to transfer from a seated position in the wheelchair to a seated position on the bed. So that's that, what that particular activity is. Now what you're going to do here is code for the least steady episode that occurs. So you could actually have people, you know, observing the resident during the look-back period and collect those episodes and code accordingly. Or you can just do the one time and code accordingly. That's basically what the manual says. But what you're going to be doing is coding each one for the least steady episode. And unsteady, as the slide says, is characterized by resident appearing unbalanced or moving with a sway or with uncoordinated or jerking movements. And most of us do sort of know what unsteady looks like, I think. And as far as gait is concerned, unsteady gait, such as, you know, fast gaits with large unsteady movements or abnormally slow or wide-based or shuffling or whatever. But those are some of the things that you might see with an unsteady gait. So code 0 for steady at all times. And this is really, let's just look at the codes first before we look at the slides. The coding. So what we're really getting at is if he was unsteady, was he able to stabilize himself without human assistance or did he need human assistance? So that's the 1 and the 2. So that's really what it's getting at. That's what you're observing for. So the code 1, not steady, but able to stabilize without staff. So you can see what it says, transitions or walking, not steady, but able to stabilize, and unsteady with assistive device, but able to stabilize, he appears at increased risk of falling. Whereas if you're coding somebody as a zero, you're thinking, this guy appears steady and not at risk for falling. So if you can kind of, you know, sort that out in your mind, that can be helpful. The code two, now this is not steady, only able to stabilize with staff assistance. And so this is where the transitions or walking are not steady and cannot stabilize without assistance of staff. Cannot stand, but can transfer unassisted, or the resident's unable to move from seated to standing or standing to seated. It's a resident who appears at high risk of falling. And also, notice this is where the lift device is used because the resident is unable to stabilize. So if any of those descriptions fit your resident, then you're going to be coding two. Not steady, only to able to stabilize with staff assistance. And then, of course, code 8 would mean that the activity did not occur at all. And, you know, I did want to mention that the code 2 would, and I think we have an example of this too, but if the resident tried to move from a seated to a standing position, but he ended up back into a seated position, then, you know, and he was never able to stabilize, then this would be a code 2 as well. But let's take a look, because sometimes the scenarios really help more than talking about definitions. So a resident locks his wheelchair and uses the arms of his wheelchair to attempt to stand. On the first attempt, he rises about halfway to a standing position, there it is, and then he sits back down again. But on the second attempt, he's able to stand steadily. So we're going to code this. Of course, he was not steady, but he was able to stabilize without staff assistance. With that first attempt, we could see that he was unsteady. So you can see how that is coded there. For this one, this is a resident with Parkinson's disease, and he ambulates with a walker. His posture is stooped. He walks slowly with a short-stepped shuffling gait. On some occasions, his gait speeds up and it appears he has difficulty slowing down. He has to steady himself using a handrail or a piece of furniture in addition to his walker on multiple occasions during the look-back period. We have a lot of residents with these sorts of problems in our facilities, don't we? And we observe them walking and we see this. For these folks, we don't often have to ask them to do a formal walking demonstration for us. So how do you think this one would be coded? Yeah, he's going to be coded as a 1 because he certainly stabilized himself without staff assistance, without human assistance. And sometimes we look at these folks and they look really unsteady and we feel like we want to go behind them because we think they're going to, but, you know, they seem to do okay. Here's another one. A resident who needs assistance ambulating transfers to his wheelchair from the bed. He's observed to stand halfway up and then sit back down on the bed. On the second attempt, a nursing assistant helps him to stand up straight, pivot, and sit down in his wheelchair. So what do you think of that one? Yeah, sounds like human assistance to me, too. Sounds like that was a good thing. Okay, so that's balance. And the last topic is functional limitation in range of motion. And really, the way that this is done hasn't changed for 3.0. I think my concern, and again, this is just me, but I think my concern is that a lot of folks never quite got it with 2.0. And so that's why we think it's important to review it here with 3.0. So first of all, what we're talking about here is, and look on the item set for GO 400. It says, code for limitation that interfered with daily functions or placed the resident at risk for injury. And the daily functions are, you know, mainly looking at ADLs. And so it's not a matter of putting, let's say, the upper extremity through range of motion like this and saying, oh, yeah, you know, her arm moves. Maybe you're doing it for me. Oh, yeah, her arm moves. If you have to do it for me, if you can't get me to move that joint by myself in any way, you don't know whether I have function. I mean, you have to assume that I don't because you're having to move it for me. So this is really based on my moving the joint myself, and, you know, maybe I'm not really able to follow directions. And the directions, by the way, you know, I already said it's not a matter of putting my arm through this range of motion. If you read the manual actually says the way to do this is have the resident place the palms on the back of the head and have the resident put palms on opposite shoulders. This is how the functional range of motion is being evaluated. And there's a similar way of not putting the feet on the shoulder or the head, but when I say similar, I don't mean that technical. I'd like to see that. But again, the lower extremity methodology is different from the standard range of motion sort of testing or exercises that we do. And the reason for that is that we're looking to see if there's a limitation that interferes with function. So let's say that I have a decreased range of motion in my shoulder. But I'm able to brush my hair, and I'm able to put my jacket on, and I can get my clothes, you know, my pants on. I might have a decreased range of motion, but it's not interfering with my function, right? So one thing you can do is just observe the resident doing ADLs. If you can't get the resident to put the palms on the back of the head, how about putting a hairbrush in her hand and see if she starts going like this? That'll get that joint going the way you want it to, right? Or maybe the hairbrush won't reach, and then you'll know the limitation is interfering with function. So for that resident who has the decreased range of motion, but it's not interfering with function, you do not capture it on the MDS in G0400. That's the point, if it doesn't interfere with function. So there are two points. The first one is the resident has to move the joints himself in order for you to evaluate it. And secondly, if it doesn't interfere with function, you don't capture it here. Now, if there's a decreased range of motion that doesn't interfere with function, that doesn't mean that you're not going to care plan some activities to help either improve the range of motion of that joint or at least to keep it from the range of motion from declining anymore. But on the MDS, because it's not interfering with function, you won't be capturing it. Okay, so that's what that's all about. So review the medical record for references to functional range of motion limitation. Discuss any impairment in functional range of motion with staff members who work with the resident and also with family and other significant others who would have reason to be aware of any of those kinds of limitations. And then conduct a thorough, comprehensive assessment following standards of practice for evaluating range of motion impairment. Review G0110 and or directly observe the resident to determine if there's any limitation that interferes with function and places the resident at risk for injury. So again, this is what this is talking about is you can just observe the resident. And if you see him carrying out activities that move the joints the way the manual says you need to test the joints, then you're done. You've observed them. If it's not that easy, then you've got to work with the resident and see. You know, sometimes you can demonstrate for the resident and get him to mimic what you did. Or maybe you can demonstrate and then you can get the joint moving, get him started, but he's got to finish the motion himself. If you've got to put the hand behind his head, it doesn't count. Okay, so assess the resident's range of motion bilaterally at the shoulder, elbow, wrist, hand, hip, knee, ankle, foot, and other joints unless contraindicated. But of course, you can see that there's just two codes you're entering for upper and lower extremities, so they're together. Staff observations can be used, as I said, and do not look at limited range of motion in isolation. In other words, you're looking at limited range of motion in the context of the resident's ability to do his ADLs. So code one or two, if the resident has an upper or lower extremity impairment. So the code one is impairment on one side, code two is impairment on both sides, if it meets this definition. So that is the range of motion. And let's see what else we have here. Whoops, sorry. I know we have a scenario there. Okay, so this resident can perform all arm, hand, and leg motions on the right side with smooth coordinated movements. She's able to perform grooming activities, brushing teeth, combing her hair with her right upper extremity, and also to pivot to her wheelchair with an assist of one person. However, she's unable to voluntarily move her left side as she has flaccid left hemiparesis from a prior stroke. So what do you think that's going to come out to? Yeah, she has upper extremity impairment on one side and also lower extremity impairment because she can't even get the joints moving. The only way you'd be able to move her joints would be passive range of motion, and that tells you that she's got an impairment. That's like big red flag, right? But she's able to, you know, do, she has full functional range of motion on the other side. Here's another one. The resident has a diagnosis of Parkinson's, ambulates with a shuffling gait. The resident has had three falls in the past quarter and often forgets his walker, which he needs to ambulate. He has tremors of both upper extremities that make it very difficult to feed himself, brush his teeth, or write. So that's probably pretty clear that he's got some functional impairment there, right? So would that be one side or both sides? Whoa, we don't have the answer there. Well, you know what the answer is. Both sides. Okay, well, that was section G.